Chapter 11. Caught under by the breeze, the awnings of the foredeck bellied upwards and collapsed slowly, and above their heavy flapping the gray stuff of Captain Wally's roomy coat fluttered incessantly around his arms and trunk. He faced the wind in full light, with his great silvery beard blown forcibly against his chest. The eyebrows overhung heavily the shadows, whence his glance appeared to be staring ahead piercingly. Stern could just detect the twin gleam of the whites shifting under the shaggy arches of the brow. At short range these eyes, for all the man's affable manner, seemed to look you through and through. Stern never could defend himself from that feeling when he had occasion to speak with his captain. He did not like it. What a big heavy man he appeared up there, with that little shrimp of a Serang in close attendance as was usual in this extraordinary steamer. Confounded absurd cuss Tom that. He resented it. Surely the old fellow could have looked after his ship without that loafing native at his elbow. Stern wriggled his shoulders with disgust. What was it? Indolence, or what? That old skipper must have been growing lazy for years. They all grew lazy out east here. Stern was very conscious of his own unimpaired activity. They got slack all over. But he towered very erect on the bridge, and quite low by his side, as you see a small child looking over the edge of a table, the battered soft hat and the brown face of the Serang peeped over the white canvas screen of the rail. No doubt the Malay was standing back, nearer to the wheel. But the great disparity of size in close association amused Stern like the observation of a bizarre fact in nature. They were as queer fish out of the sea as any in it. He saw Captain Wally turn his head quickly to speak to his Serang. The wind whipped the whole white mass of the beard sideways. He would be directing the chap to look at the compass for him, or what not. Of course. Too much trouble to step over and see for himself. Stern's scorn for that bodily indolence which overtakes white men in the East increased on reflection. Some of them would be utterly lost if they hadn't all these natives at their beck and call. They grew perfectly shameless about it too. He was not of that sort, thank God. It wasn't in him to make himself dependent for his work on any shriveled up little Malay like that. As if one could ever trust a silly native for anything in the world. But that fine old man thought differently, it seems. There they were together, never far apart, a pair of them, recalling to the mind an old whale attended by a little pilot fish. The fancifulness of the comparison made him smile. A whale with an inseparable pilot fish. That's what the old man looked like. For it could not be said he looked like a shark, though Mr. Massey had called him that very name. But Mr. Massey did not mind what he said in his savage fits. Stern smiled to himself and gradually the ideas evoked by the sound, by the imagined shape of the word pilot fish, the ideas of aid, of guidance needed and received, came uppermost in his mind. The word pilot awakened the idea of trust, of dependence, the idea of welcome, clear-eyed help brought to the seaman groping for the land in the dark, groping blindly in fogs, feeling their way in the thick weather of the gales that, filling the air with a salt mist blown up from the sea, contract the range of sight on all sides to a shrunken horizon that seems within reach of the hand. A pilot sees better than a stranger, because his local knowledge, like a sharper vision, completes the shapes of things hurriedly glimpsed, penetrates the veils of mist spread over the land by the storms of the sea, defines with certitude the outlines of a coast lying under the pall of fog, the forms of landmarks half buried in a starless night as in a shallow grave. He recognizes because he already knows. It is not to his far-reaching eye, but to his more extensive knowledge, that the pilot looks for certitude. For this certitude of the ship's poseidon on which may depend a man's good fame, and the peace of his conscience, the justification of the trust deposited in his hands, with his own life too, which is seldom wholly his to throw away, and the humble lives of others rooted in distant affections, perhaps, and made as weighty as the lives of kings by the burden of the awaiting mystery. The pilot's knowledge brings relief and certitude to the commander of a ship, The Serang, however, in his fanciful suggestion of a pilot fish attending a whale, could not in any way be credited with a superior knowledge. Why should he have it? These two men had come on that run together, the white and the brown, on the same day. And of course a white man would learn more in a week than the best native would in a month. He was made to stick to the skipper, as though he were of some use, as the pilot fish, they say, is to the whale. But how, it was very marked how. A pilot fish, a pilot, a dot dot, but if not superior knowledge, then dot dot, Stern's discovery was made. It was repugnant to his imagination, shocking to his ideas of honesty, shocking to his conception of mankind. This enormity affected one's outlook on what was possible in this world. It was as if, for instance, the sun had turned blue, throwing a new and sinister light on men and nature. Really, in the first moment he had felt sickish, as though he had got a blow below the belt. For a second the very color of the sea seemed changed, appeared queer to his wandering eye, and he had a passing, unsteady sensation in all his limbs, as though the earth had started turning the other way. A very natural incredulity succeeding this sense of upheaval brought a measure of relief. He had gasped, it was over. But afterwards, during all that day, sudden paroxysms of wonder would come over him in the midst of his occupations. He would stop and shake his head. The revolt of his incredulity had passed away almost as quick as the first emotion of discovery, and for the next 24 hours he had no sleep. That would never do. At meal times, he took the foot of the table set up for the white men on the bridge. He could not help losing himself in a fascinated contemplation of Captain Wally opposite. He watched the deliberate upward movements of the arm. The old man put his food to his lips, as though he never expected to find any taste in his daily bread, as though he did not know anything about it. He fed himself like a somnambulist. "'Tis an awful sight," thought Stern, and he watched the long period of mournful, silent immobility, with a big brown hand lying loosely close by the side of the plate, till he noticed the two engineers to the right and left looking at him in astonishment. He would close his mouth in a hurry then, and lowering his eyes, wink rapidly at his plate. It was awful to see the old chap sitting there. It was even awful to think that with three words he could blow him up sky high. All he had to do was to raise his voice and pronounce a single short sentence, and yet that simple act seemed as impossible to attempt as moving the sun out of its place in the sky. The old chap could eat in his terrific mechanical way, but Stern, from mental excitement, could not that evening, at any rate. He had had ample time since to get accustomed to the strain of the meal hours. He would never have believed it. But then news is everything. Only the very potency of his success prevented anything resembling elation. He felt like a man who, in his legitimate search for a loaded gun, to help him on his way through the world, chances to come upon a torpedo upon a live torpedo with a shattering charge in its head, and a pressure of many atmospheres in its tail. It is the sort of weapon to make its possessor careworn and nervous. He had no mind to be blown up himself, and he could not get rid of the notion that the explosion was bound to damage him too in some way. This vague apprehension had restrained him at first. He was able now to eat and sleep with that fearful weapon by his side, with the conviction of its power always in mind. It had not been arrived at by any reflective process, but once the idea had entered his head, the conviction had followed overwhelmingly in the multitude of observed little facts to which, before, he had given only a languid attention. The abrupt and faltering intonations of the deep voice, the taciturnity put on like an armor, the deliberate, as if guarded, movements, the long immobilities, as if the man he watched had been afraid to disturb the very air. Every familiar gesture, every word uttered in his hearing, every sigh overheard, had acquired a special significance, a confirmatory import. Every day that passed over the Cephala appeared to Stern simply crammed full with proofs, with incontrovertible proofs. At night, when off duty, he would steal out of his cabin in pajamas for more proofs, and stand a full hour, perhaps, on his bare feet below the bridge, as absolutely motionless as the awning stanchion in its deck socket nearby. On the stretches of easy navigation, it is not usual for a coasting captain to remain on deck all the time of his watch. The Serang keeps it for him as a matter of custom. In open water, on a straight course, he is usually trusted to look after the ship by himself. But this old man seemed incapable of remaining quietly down below. No doubt he could not sleep. And no wonder. This was also a proof. Suddenly in the silence of the ship panting upon the still, dark sea, Stern would hear a low voice above him exclaiming nervously, "Serang! Tuan! You are watching the compass well?" "Yes, I am watching, Tuan. The ship is making her course?" "She is, Tuan. Very straight." "It is well. And remember, Serang, that the order is that you are to mind the helmsman, and keep a lookout with care, the same as if I were not on deck." Then, when the Serang had made his answer, the low tones on the bridge would cease, and everything round Stern seemed to become more still and more profoundly silent. Slightly chilled and with his back aching a little from long immobility, he would steal away to his room on the port side of the deck. He had long since parted with the last vestige of incredulity, of the original emotions, set into a tumult by the discovery, some trace of the first awe alone remained. Not the awe of the man himself, he could blow him up sky high with 6 words, rather it was an awestruck indignation at the reckless perversity of avarice.
What else could it be?
At the mad and somber resolution, that for the sake of a few dollars more seemed to set at naught the common rule of conscience, and pretended to struggle against the very decree of providence. You could not find another man like this one in the whole round world, thank God. There was something devilishly dauntless in the character of such a deception which made you pause. Other considerations occurring to his prudence had kept him tongue-tied from day to day. It seemed to him now that it would yet have been easier to speak out in the first hour of discovery. He almost regretted not having made a row at once. But then the very monstrosity of the disclosure. Why? He could hardly face it himself, let alone pointing it out to somebody else. Moreover, with a desperado of that sort one never knew. The object was not to get him out,
that was as well as done already,
but to step into his place. Bizarre as the thought seemed, he might have shown fight. A fellow up to working such a fraud would have enough cheek for anything. A fellow that, as it were, stood up against God Almighty himself. He was a horrid marvel, that's what he was. He was perfectly capable of brazening out the affair scandalously till he got him Stern, kicked out of the ship, and everlastingly damaged his prospects in this part of the East. Yet if you want to get on, something must be risked. At times Stern thought he had been unduly timid of taking action in the past, and what was worse, it had come to this, that in the present he did not seem to know what action to take. Massey's savage moroseness was too disconcerting. It was an incalculable factor of the situation. You could not tell what there was behind that insulting ferocity. How could one trust such a temper? It did not put Stern in bodily fear for himself, but it frightened him exceedingly, as to his prospects. Though of course inclined to credit himself with exceptional powers of observation, he had by now lived too long with his discovery. He had gone on looking at nothing else, till at last one day it occurred to him that the thing was so obvious that no one could miss seeing it. There were 4 white men in all on board the Sofala. Jack, the second engineer, was too dull to notice anything that took place out of his engine room. Remained Massey, the owner, the interested person nearly going mad with worry. Stern had heard and seen more than enough on board to know what ailed him, but his exasperation seemed to make him deaf to cautious overtures. If he had only known it, there was the very thing he wanted. But how could you bargain with a man of that sort? It was like going into a tiger's den with a piece of raw meat in your hand. he was as likely as not to rend you for your pains. In fact, he was always threatening to do that very thing, and the urgency of the case, combined with the impossibility of handling it with safety, made Stern in his watches below toss, and mutter open-eyed in his bunk, for hours, as though he had been burning with fever. Occurrences like the crossing of the bar just now were extremely alarming to his prospects. He did not want to be left behind by some swift catastrophe. Massey being on the bridge, the old man had to brace himself up and make a show, he supposed. But it was getting very bad with him, very bad indeed, now. Even Massey had been emboldened to find fault this time. Stern, listening at the foot of the ladder, had heard the other's whimpering and artless denunciations. Luckily the beast was very stupid, and could not see the why of all this. However, small blame to him, it took a clever man to hit upon the cause. Nevertheless, it was high time to... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.